But I'll tell you, when they get the letter from legal, it also notes that these are explicit violations of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. And when I see people read that, I see some genuine contrition.
The Adversarial Podcast. Why you gotta be so adversarial? It's time to get adversarial.
Hey guys, welcome back. We're at episode 20 now, since the three of us have been doing this, and I stopped doing my solo long-winded rants before. Thanks for bailing me out, joining me, guys. Good to have a little mini anniversary celebration. Mario, you're looking good there. You got some high-def, new hi-fi equipment there and all of that. What have you been up to lately? Are things going well?
All I'm going to say is the microphone works now.
We're getting the basics down on this podcast a little. Sunil, you're always sounding good and boomy as usual. And you're actually in town, so good.
Yeah.
I'm glad for you.
Got home earlier than expected, and it's beautiful here in D.C. with the cherry blossoms out, despite all the chaos happening in Washington, D.C.
I attribute most of that to you.
I do have to say something, though. Sunil and I had... we've known each other for a little bit now, but we've never personally met until last week.
Oh, yeah. And where were you?
We were at the Cynet, right, Sunil?
Cynet conference, yeah. It shocked me that we hadn't actually met in person until that point.
Fantastic. Well, good. We got a lot of stuff to talk about. Before we launch into a story that's like 10 days old, which seems ancient, just so that we don't lose everybody in the first few minutes, we're going to talk about Google acquisition of Wiz and the cyber market. And yes, we are going to speak about the Signal snafu out of D.C. there. Some the GitHub action supply chain attacks lately. I think that's really something worth talking about. And this developing Oracle breach that seems to be trickling out. So we're going to go through quite a bit, but... I thought we'd kick off with a really unique one here, which was this lawsuit alleging that the company Deel cultivated this corporate spy to infiltrate a competitor and did their own investigation and caught this guy red-handed and that they're going after him. And this is Rippling's team that did all of this. I'm afraid that this confirms what people always, sometimes like the layperson in cybersecurity always says, like, oh yeah, we got to worry about competitors. And I always felt like, nah, actually you don't. Most of the time that's pretty unrealistic. Do you guys agree with me, or are you saying, oh yeah, I've always been telling you, Jerry, this goes on all the time?
I think certainly there are significant legal repercussions here that should put people in jail, right? I don't know to what degree the... there's certainly civil. There's reasons for civil lawsuits. I don't quite know. I'm not a lawyer, so I can't tell you what the criminal implications are for some of these things. But that generally is a reason why people don't to do these things, right? When you have certain countries where that type of thing is enforced, it creates enough of a deterrent for the executives to not do something like this. There are certainly other countries where this is a bit more. Accepted, I guess. I've heard, and this is not firsthand, but this is from secondhand information, that there are other countries like China where it's more condoned, almost, right? It's fair game, so to speak. And that's why we see it happening to us just as much as it happens to domestic companies within China as well.
More of a dog-eat-dog mentality.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the way I treated this, I remember in financial services... When cybersecurity really became a thing, 20 years ago or so, and while we didn't know it at the time, what we were trying to do was really establish our threat profile, right? Like, what are the priorities for every given business, which everybody should be doing? And this one came up a lot, especially in capital markets and trading, right? You have adversarial math in markets, right? Literally. So it always came up with, well, what if so-and-so... What if investment bank B found out investment banks A algo, high-frequency trading algorithms, and traded ahead? And there were these baked-in assumptions of, I know they're trying to. They've got to. And part of it is because the people that are, running all these companies used to work in the other ones, and they're kind of saying, well, I would do it. But I generally, partly for the reasons you mentioned, I just felt like it would be extraordinarily rare because of the criminal penalties and the potential crippling effects on the company. And then how do you pay someone and how do you even do that accounting wise? You have a criminal on the books, right? So I guess my point is, I don't think this should move the needle on threat profiling and that everyone needs to worry about this. I feel like at this point it's still isolated. Would you feel differently or advise companies differently about their insider threat programs based on this intel?
I wouldn't react to this, but we really work hard for our insider program. I think one of the benefits, I'm not espousing the benefits of by itself doing an insider program. I think it's really difficult to do, quite honestly. But what it does help, there some of the things that we learned were that it improved our visibility into certain things that we weren't seeing. So even let's suppose that an insider changed the insider from voluntarily trying to steal information to somebody's laptop, work laptop, being compromised by an attacker. And then that attacker is using the credentials or the system as if it were the user, and then stealing data, moving data. So they're very close cousins, insider programs and an attacker gaining access to somebody's machine and exfiltrating data. So there was definitely benefits that we gained out of that.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. That's something I've been wanting to talk about for a while, insider threat and what the definition is, because I remember it was probably about 10 years ago, maybe 15, because it was before the resiliency wave. But before that, it was insider threat, and that's what everybody's talking about. And in particular, especially in financial services, it meant people were starting an insider threat program, which meant hiring people, giving them that title. They often had an adjacency to law enforcement in their history, and kind of shaming people who didn't have the insider threat program. And that all gets into this normal regulatory wind of, now the examination wants to ask, what is your insider threat program? So the way these things normally work, they're so vague that people can say, oh, yeah, we have an insider threat program, and just kind of throw existing controls and say that's why. I, in the early days, felt like, oh, that we've always had that. That's everything we're using about endpoint protection and about user behavioral analytics and that sort of thing. That's insider threat. And it was, I didn't want to create a program because, does that take the SOC off the hook? And what's the difference in the SOC? And what I ultimately concluded was that insider threat was everything that was only had to do with a rogue employee. And so it went it went into background checks. Social media monitoring, is someone on the take? Do they have a gambling problem? Are they prone towards violence? And it had nothing to do with malware. Well, that wasn't the initial entry point. It was distinct from your computer is compromised by an outsider, because that's been the cyber problem forever, and we don't need a new program for that. Recently, though, I saw a definition of insider threat. It was in the Know Before training, actually, which makes it authoritative, right, because they're out there teaching millions of people. And of course, like the Know Before training often is, it was very, here's a definition of a term. Can you regurgitate that to us or not? And it was insider threat. Which of the following are examples of an insider threat? And you had to choose an external compromise. Someone got malware. And that was the correct inclusion in insider threat. And if you didn't choose that, you failed that. Is that how everybody's been thinking, or was my definition right?
Well, I think the external attacker posing as an insider is not really, quote, an insider attack in how I think most of us look at it. There is a substantial challenge, though, I think, in running some of these insider threat programs, especially as it relates to how those programs are in larger organizations are usually segmented off from the rest of the security team. I don't know how it was with you, Jerry, but at Bank of America, we had the insider threat team, and the content that they looked at really was tightly segmented for privacy reasons. And the ability to coordinate across, it was kind of, in some respects, a one-way It was a one-way street, right, in terms of information going to the insider threat team, but nothing really coming out. And I can see why that would be the case, or why that needed to be the case for the sake of various equities around just our own privacy. But at the same time, as that space converges more with the endpoint compromises and network-based compromises and so on and so forth, we're going to have to find a way to address those privacy concerns, but still bring all those data points together. Because what looks like an insider threat initially may end up being an external attack, and that's the only indicator that we have before we get fully owned.
This is such a very complex topic because there's so many angles you can look at this stuff. If you look at Code 42, and you're all familiar with Code 42, one of the things they've espoused, and I, based on the data that we saw, I think they were kind of right. A little bit. Okay, I'll just say maybe not uber perfectly right, 100% right, but there was something there. And that was around an employee quitting or sending a notice, I'm going to quit in 2 weeks, 3 weeks. Or most of it was when an employee was quitting, right? They were going to say they're sending a termination. It was going to be 2 to 3 weeks notice, whatever that was. And sure enough, spikes. You were a developer. You downloaded a ton of code. Some of it wasn't even your code. It was everybody's code. Sometimes they did it accidentally. I get it. It's not a good conversation, folks. And on the sales side, you had the salespeople going to their Salesforce or whatever they had, they contained their data for their contacts. And it wasn't just their customers, but the entire enchilada. Not that that gives you any if it's your own customers, you should not be doing that, folks. You don't get in trouble. Don't do that. Read the policies of your company. I'm not suggesting that you could do that or not. But yeah. Right.
Those were earlier indicators of potential levers even before they put in their notice.
Correct.
So that was a flag that we had as well. There was another way that we tracked this, and that's when you know they're going to leave before, because it's a contract sort of thing. So interns were my favorite example. We know exactly when they're leaving because that's when they go back to school. And to Mario's point, the expected actions are almost like textbook for nearly every intern. You expect them to try to pull down information because they consider it theirs, right? And I mean, to a large degree, I don't blame them. It's like, hey, I'd like to just keep my own work, right? Just because it's something that I put time and energy into. Unfortunately, corporations have different views on that.
But that's the difference between, again, and help me, Jerry, on this one, but malware getting installed on my machine and accidentally and then stealing data, it might look very similar to an insider. The difference is the context. For an insider, an example would be, I'm going to leave the company in 2 weeks and I put my notice, right? As opposed to, so the patterns may look the same, grabbing data, a ton of data and exfiltrating it out. But the difference, the nuance is the employee's quitting. And that's an easy one.
And to me, it all comes down to what are the actions that you take. And like, it's the only reason it's worth talking about is, okay, you want to have an insider threat department. What is their remit and how does it differ from the rest of this? Maybe cybersecurity, maybe Supra, maybe beyond cybersecurity, maybe it's an HR, who knows? And I think that's a valid question. And that's why I don't think if you have an insider threat group, I don't think they're saying, hey, this laptop, this user is suddenly dumping Active Directory and moving laterally. And like, you know, that's SOC stuff. That's probably a third party. But it's the, hey, they're accessing the CEO's email and reading it because they're an IT admin, right? Or something like that, you know, very specific gossipy type stuff. And what you guys were talking about, we used to call it hit it and quit it. It was where you'd exfiltrate a bunch of data and then put in your notice, right? And the way that we did it, and it's not to say this is a great way or whatever, but I think it was pretty cool, is we called it Hotel Mike. So it was an HM, really secretly stood for heightened monitoring. And we would say, we're checking someone into Hotel Mike. And that was our way of having these conversations with HR in the hallway or that kind of thing, or even an email. We'd get one in and it would be a spreadsheet. It would say, okay, here's the people to check in this week. And it was just like Sunil said, like the people who were rolling off of their contracts, people had put in notice, and we would put them in the user behavioral monitoring system with had a suspicion score, and it would just add plus X, whatever it is, so that things like DLP would get looked at, whereas 2 weeks ago they probably would have gotten ignored because these systems are noisy, you know. But I think that there's a few audiences here. So one is we got a lot of CISOs that are listening to us, and they're all, I'm sure, like, oh, that's interesting. I've thought about this. We did it differently. We did it better. We did it worse, and so on. But then there's the other 99.9% of people who are getting busted by these programs. And they always say the same thing, right? They always say, oh, I didn't know. Oh, I was just trying to work on this. And it's kind of a – and then you get them to sign an affidavit, which basically means email back. Yeah, I promise I deleted all it, and it's all gone. So for the average software developer, intern, and so on, it's almost like, oh, yeah, let's just do it. All I got to do is play dumb at the end of the day. But I'll tell you, when they get the letter from legal, it doesn't just – for one, it always has to say that pending last paycheck, you're not going to get it unless you satisfy this. You got to have some leverage, so you got to catch them quick for that. But then it also notes that these are explicit violations of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and that there's potential litigation possible here. And when I see people read that, I see some genuine contrition. Like it is no longer, yeah, I knew this day was coming and I'll just pretend. At that point, I see some, sorry, I really, and it went from, I didn't know I shouldn't do this. What they really mean is I didn't realize that you would actually call the police. And then things move pretty quick. So I think people should just be aware that it's super explicitly stated in code. I'm talking about criminal code. And you can and will get directly prosecuted for this sort of thing, especially if you have some other bad relationship and reason to piss someone off.
It's also very, it gets to the, to 11, you know, you dial it to 11. You know, right? When you leave the company and you're going to a competitor of the company. And that's when you take it to 11. And you know, I think we've all been in that situation where a former employee did something like that. It's never good. And this is what this case reminds me of as well. It was competitor. I mean, I think there was a... you know, when you're doing also when people are doing Zoom calls or doing PowerPoint presentations, we would have it, you know, you have browsers. We're going to talk about corporate browsers, but some of the corporate browsers will do a watermark of, you know, your name. So if somebody takes a screen capture of it and then it's, you know, maybe you and you upload it and give it to somebody else, you might get caught. Although nowadays there are tools that can circumvent that and get rid of the watermark.
I'm a fan of the clandestine watermarks even more, right? Because if it says Mario right across the front of it, you're like, oh, I can't share that. But if it's just like encoded and in some little random string and you're sharing it like crazy and then later someone's like, yeah, we know you took it, Mario. It said in Base64 encoding, Mario took this at the bottom. I think that's better actually. Like, otherwise, the people are just going to run and hide. All right. Moving on, shifting a little bit. Since the last episode, there's been a few deals, a few big deals. The obvious huge elephant in the room is Google acquiring Wiz. You know, that really unwinds. When we talked about the retracted offer news X months ago, supposedly there was a $23 billion deal, I think, for Wiz from Google. And the narrative was, I thought it was spun, that Wiz... said they rebuffed them. And I just thought, like, nah, they just either didn't really get that offer or Google really pulled it and they're just trying to save face. That's what I thought and that's what I shared on the podcast. Clearly wrong, right? Not only did Google come back to the table, but they paid almost 50% more. So clearly that offer was legit and they were very interested and it looks much more likely that Wiz was being completely accurate in saying that they were the ones walking away. So the other piece of the market news, and I'll throw them both out there before I get your reactions into this, is Island Enterprise Browser. I'm an advisor to them, have been for a long time. Sunil, I believe you are as well. So that's just a little note of disclosure in there. There are a number of very small enterprise browser companies coming along. Google itself has a nascent offering. I say nascent in that I think feature-wise it's nascent. And Talon, which was bought by Palo Alto, was launched around the same time as Silent. So there's my disclosure out of the way. There are other things out there, and I'm not advocating for one over the other. But anyway, the news about Island was that they raised $250 million at another increase of valuation, which puts it at just shy of $5 billion, which is a lot. So the questions are these isolated incidents? Are these reflecting on the companies? Or is this saying that the market's coming back, at least for cybersecurity? Will we see public stocks following suit around cyber? Will we see early venture-type deals heating up?
Well, I think the exits always draw more interest because the investors see potential. And so I suspect that we're going to see more VC interest in cybersecurities overall. There's another subtext to this, which I do want to hit upon, which is it's interesting that both of these companies are also cyber starts companies. And if you recall, about a year ago, we had that whole hubbub about the kickbacks, I guess, of some sort to CISOs or to those who made some of these deals happen. So it speaks to a couple things. I don't know if this is a universal statement or if it's a, you know, or what to make of it. But whatever they were doing is working. Is it because of the kickbacks? I hope not. I mean, I think none of us would hope that that's the case because it just creates such perverse incentives. But that's it. CyberStarts has done a pretty good job of picking big winners here.
Well, I'd like to begin by congratulating four of those people, the founders of Wiz. You are now $4 billion richer. God bless you. Great work. So let's start with that. There is news from a company that's coming out of stealth, and they weren't ready to be, you know, talked about yet, but I heard about it from somebody who shared the news with me from a company in Israel, and the news came from Israel. And this kind of reminds me back to the Wiz when the news got leaked out. Remember when it got leaked out and we thought it was all just noise, somebody was making it up. I don't know what's going on out there in the media in Israel, but there's a lot of leaking going on over there, all right? It's really interesting how I think maybe all of that is connected also with some of these VCs and maybe some acts that are not, they're not really straight. You know, it's kind of, the cynic in me is a little bit disappointed with just the whole market, right? Here are folks who are not behave or comported themselves. I don't know if it's honorable or not, but they haven't been very clean. But they're getting away with it. They're making a ton of money. What do you think is going to happen? How are we going to continue to encourage this?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think after that little dust up that people kind of had their hands slapped, and hopefully the CISOs that were involved in that, hid for a while, and maybe they had their names tarnished a little bit, and the other companies were going to hire them said, oh, I see what's going to go on here. That said, I never heard much more about it about a month after that, and I think we're probably the first ones to bring it back up. And unfortunately, you're right, Sunil, a little bit of story is, hey, it worked out. Look, that said, I mean, the way that model would have worked, if as alleged, right, is that it planted some immediate sweetheart deals. You know, oh, we can generate X number of accounts, logos, ARR, because for insincere reasons. Fast forward, these are legit products. They're really strong products. I've been using Wiz myself a good bit lately and gotten more immersed in it. And they damn well better be. I mean, they've raised so much money that they better have been able to put some serious engineering effort into these. So at this point, you know, they are standing on their merits, without a doubt.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But I don't like the ends justifies the means. So I do hope we all, and it's really incumbent upon the VCs to not espouse that kind of insincere marketing early on.
If we go look at the case itself with Wiz, and just forget about this other stuff that we talked about from like CyberStarts and how they comported themselves. Why did Google do this? Why did they pay so much money?
Oh, yeah.
You know, ultimately, Wiz folks, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to say probably most of the customers for Wiz are in AWS today. Probably less in Google, GCP, and maybe a little bit more in Azure. So what's going to happen? Is Wiz going to, I mean, now that it's in Google, you think Google is going to want to support in AWS and Azure? That's not the way they behave. That's not what they've done in the past, right? They want to come in and they say, so we're going to have it just for GCP because they think that's going to help GCP. I'm not making this up. You can just look at all their acquisitions and how they comported themselves and what they've done. Mm-hmm. And they basically want to get out the AWS support in Azure and make GCP look better. For $32 billion to make GCP better, I just don't get it. They're going to lose a lot of customers. So what are they going to use this for?
Well, I mean, this is purely speculative because we don't know yet what they plan to do. And there is a lot of potential antitrust hair on it, both as the deal closes and then also in how they comport themselves later and whether it's anti-competitive behavior. Setting all that aside, one model I came up with in my mind was if Wiz is expensive and if Google said you get Wiz for free, if you're in GCP, but otherwise you pay the same old price, it doesn't have to be any higher, with full functionality, they don't have to handicap it in AWS or Azure. Maybe I'm wrong, but I feel like that's not quite an antitrust or anti-competitive issue. But so long as the playing field is otherwise equal, and I hear more and more people are getting close to a toss-up on these platforms. I mean, it was just AWS, and I think AWS still has massive market share because a lot of companies started in AWS, but now companies that launch out today and get to pick one, I think it's pretty much equal. And if the security team is saying, I recommend GCP, and no one else is fighting back, it could make a difference.
I don't know if it's the security team that wins that decision. I think it's the developers who win that decision in terms of which cloud.
Is pushing back.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, at this point in time, we would be comfortable enough with AWS security that we would. There's not a reason to push back if a developer wanted to use AWS over GCP.
Well, that's a good question. I mean, as a security pro, if GCP came with Wiz, and the other ones you're gonna have to pay for it, which means I'm gonna have to fight for it and I have to go budget for it. I would say GCP is more secure. They're all equal. It's all up to how you configure them, but. Adding Wiz in, the whole point is that it makes people more likely to configure things correctly.
I was having this conversation with a former colleague of mine this week about this acquisition, and they were basically saying most people are not really using cloud configuration monitoring and determining whether there's been some errors in your cloud. I don't agree with that, but that was his position, and rather it was more around the CVEs. I was like, wow, that's so frustrating. Really? Yeah. CVEs, that's what Wiz is doing. And I think that...
Oh, the argument was that most Wiz users are
CVEs. Yeah, they were just trying to get really what it... I mean, why Wiz and Orca is in this space as well. What made them unique or better than the established player, which I think we can all agree was Tenable, or is Tenable... It's a Tenable dependent on agents, and managing agents is a pain in the butt.
Yeah.
Okay, so these guys came out with a better solution. Yes, they also looked at the cloud configuration, which I like that, by the way. I want to know more about the errors that are happening in the cloud rather than the CVEs. But my former colleague argued that, no, actually, it's the CVEs that were more important because compliance people could easily say, look at all these CVEs that you're missing. You got to go take care of them. Well, you try to keep up with that, when your agent deployments are constantly failing with Tenable and they're not working, it made it easier to use something like a Wiz or an Orca.
I would say that they're not necessarily more important. They just happen to be more observable, maybe, or more countable, rather than actually being important. I think no one would dispute that a bad cloud configuration could be significantly worse than a whole bunch of medium CVEs.
I'll go further than that. I would contend that cloud configuration contributes more critical risks than CVEs, including, 9 to 10 CVSS CVEs. And cloud config is everything. I think we're all in agreement on that. I mean, not as everything, but it is some of the most crucial, leads to some of the most serious incidents.
Unfortunately, the reason why a configuration is harder to adjudicate is because it requires more context.
Yep.
Whereas a CVE, it's bad just because it has a certain score. Whether you fix it requires context as well. But whether it's a cloud configuration or a CVE, both require context. But a configuration requires two levels of context. One, is it good or bad? And then two, do you fix it? Whereas a CVE, you already know it's bad. And therefore, that's why the compliance people can say, oh, hey, that's bad. It doesn't matter what the context is. Go fix it. I'm like, well, hold on. There's more context behind this. But anyway, that's it. It's harder. It's more obscure. Configurations are more obscure to understand by the auditor, just because, again, the context could make it entirely fine.
But do you folks, I think we all agree that errors and misconfigurations in your cloud provider can cause a lot of issues, right? That and people are exploiting it. I believe they're exploiting it more than CVEs in the cloud. That's just my, right? Mm-hmm. But here you go. I think, do we agree that the reason why Wiz became so popular is not because of the cloud configuration, but rather because they weren't using agents?
Well, hold on. There's something else to that, though. One thing that Wiz is pretty good at with CVEs, it's not just that it finds things by looking through workloads and not having to have agents on there. It's also because it does contextualize the CVEs. It says these CVEs are not accessible from the internet. And these are, and that's what we've been needing desperately. Like, to Sunil's point a minute ago, the behavior that CVEs were easy because you just know they're bad, I couldn't disagree more. And I mean, I think we're on the same page there, but I think that was a massive error by compliance-minded staff. CVEs are not bad without context. They're completely useless. And if you say, well, I'm gonna go after them, because then you're bit site, right? And you're just like, well, all I could see is TLS version. So that's the flag I'm gonna fly.
No, I'm saying that a CVE is bad. It's just whether you need to fix it is the issue, right? In terms of having the additional context. If it's not reachable, I don't care to fix it, right?
Yeah, but and Wiz is doing a lot of that. So if somebody said, hey, I like Wiz because of CVEs, I would say, well, before you say that's stupid because CVEs are stupid, say, well, hold on. If you're using that to justify reasonably all in good enough context to supply to an examiner why you're not fixing 90% of them, that's good. That's a very good outcome. And it's better than what, you know, an agent could have done.
Right.
Like my teams that I work with, I always, and please, compliance people, don't take it the wrong way, but I'm a security guy. I'm not a compliance guy. Okay. All right. But what we're talking about here, really, we're talking about kind of a compliance issue here. And what Jerry, what I'm trying to read between the lines here is, because this exploit, the CVE, might look critical, but in my deployment, because Wiz and Orca gives me the ability to say, no, that's a low, that's really not impactful, I can tell my compliance person, hey, I don't need to patch that within 30 days. I don't have that that as an issue. But that's a compliance issue, and I think Sunil brings it really clearly when he states that it's very visible. It's easy to make sense of it. I worry as a security person. I worry more about misconfigurations in the cloud environment than I do about a CVE.
100% agree with you.
But we're in the wrong. We're clearly in the wrong because people are making a mark. That's what I'm trying to highlight. I think
these cloud security posture management platforms, so let's go super Wiz, are good at putting CVEs in context because they're monitoring the cloud configuration. Like, the reason why a Vuln scanner doesn't do that is not just because it's agent based. It's because all it has is the local workload vantage point. What you need is to know that the ACLs are preventing someone from talking to that on port 22, right? It is non-CVE context you need, and that's why the cloud service provider. So in addition to finding bad configs, they're able to use configs to determine what's truly a bad vulnerability. Let's talk about Signal, right? We absolutely have to. So there's great coverage on this one. So fortunately, we don't have to handle all that part of the story here. But what I think does make sense is let's talk about Signal a little bit. It's a security tool. I suspect you guys as well have used it for a long time. We heard about it long before the entire planet who've heard about it in the last week. And I mean, I guess one of the things that comes up with this story is someone might say, well, it's okay what happened because Signal is secure. Or someone else might say, this proves Signal is not secure. And I think that goes to people confuse different threat objectives, right? Are you talking about the encryption and the confidentiality of data from someone who's intercepting messages? Or are you talking about the way someone is using technology?
Yeah. So let's settle a couple things to bound the conversation. This is not about whether or not someone should put classified information into Signal and the whole, I think everyone's pretty much on the same page on that, that was like idiotic and amateur hour and all that kind of stuff. There are a couple things that we should still take away from this that points to potential ways that we look at controls and what we should be on the lookout for. So I've made an argument that the UI of Signal itself could be improved to know when you've added somebody that is not in your contact list. So right now there's a small little head icon for those who you have a contact for, but if you don't have a contact for that person, it's just missing. And so it's really hard for us from a user experience standpoint to see the missing icon, right? You need to actually have something visible to know that something's maybe not right. And so having a more visible indicator when something is potentially problematic is the kind of indicator that we need rather than the absence of an indicator.
This could be like the 10-second rule before you send the email. Yeah, look, as you know, where you could clearly show 10, 9, 8, and there is a blinking thing. This is an external party. This is not part of your company email, right? And maybe you get a chance like, oops, I made a mistake. I added somebody there by mistake, right? Because this happens, switch Signal. And I think what Sunil highlights a really important point is the interface, the user interface, and not giving enough warning that that person doesn't belong to your company.
Well, in this case, the person that Mike Waltz, who added Jeffrey Goldberg, clearly had Jeffrey in his contact list. So Mike Waltz would not have noticed anything odd. However, the other people who were on the group chat would have said, hey, who's this JG guy, right? He's not on my contact list. And there's a very big indicator that should be there to indicate that that's not, that this is somebody that's unknown.
Unless you send you put up a list that you constantly add people in, just the list, it's just the name of the list. You don't see the actual people in the list and you add them by, look, I think ultimately, you got to look at the criticality of the information you have. And I know I'm going to say some bad stuff here, but sometimes we need to employ more controls based on a sensitivity and a criticality of the service or the data. I think we don't do ourselves a service by allowing everybody to make human errors. We're looking at human errors here.
Well, this is a easy human error to make, and I think this one's a pretty bad one to make as well, no question about that. And again, we're not talking about whether or not they should have even been having classified chats here. I mean, that's a given, right? We know that's a given. The perspective here is that mistakes will be made in passive tense. We will make those mistakes just as much as anybody else will. And so how do we create the right visual cues to ensure that that doesn't happen? There's another piece that's also important to recognize with the Signal issue, which is, I think it was Ratcliffe who said, hey, my computer came with it installed by default. In fact, it wasn't not just that it came installed by default, but the Biden administration sanctioned it for use, back before this administration. I think that's a good idea to have a sanctioned end-to-end fully encrypted Signal messaging application. But here's the challenge with it. If the tool is available to us to use, we will tend to use it and overuse it for purposes beyond what we've originally prescribed, right? I think we have to just assume that that's going to happen plan for the worst. There's no question. Well, I don't know if there's no question, but it'd be hard pressed to believe that there haven't been other communications that have happened over Signal amongst officials that border, if not go right into the classified arena, right? No, I don't doubt that. I mean, rather, it'd be hard for me to believe that that hasn't already happened. We just don't know about it, right? And so if it's going to happen, and again, I'm not saying it's good or bad. In fact, I'm saying it's bad. We shouldn't do that. But we also have to recognize that it's going to happen. And if it's going to happen, let's make sure that it's as foolproof as possible, because it's going to happen.
Yeah, you know, I also, though, think there's a lot of, this just points to all kinds of confusion in what you're protecting against, right? So if you think about like message communication vectors, and I'll go back to financial services again, I think like in banking, when you're thinking about evaluating different communication paths, message interception, like at the state level, is not a very important threat. I don't think that's what everybody should be worrying about. And so the relevant control for that, which is end-to-end encryption, isn't super important for banking conversations. What is important is message supervision for insider trading and compliance and message copying. So, you know, we were always told you can't go and use something that's off the record. I think in a highest level cabinet US Gov situation, both are on the table. You have to worry about end-to-end encryption. And then you also have to comply with message retention, even more so than you would have to in financial services, if that's at all possible. So I bet the reason why Signal was rolling around everywhere was because of that FBI comm that went out, or at least the predecessor comms that turned into that FBI, because I think that was only about a month ago, maybe 2 months ago, where there was an FBI advisement to the nation of watch out. People might be monitoring your messages. Signal is one of the things you could use to, which was so weird to me for law enforcement to be advising a specific product, but also for law enforcement to tell the 99.9% of its audience that is listening to it, who shouldn't be worried about nation states intercepting their comms at the telecom. And they were suggesting a solution to that problem for a lot of people who don't have that problem, and blowing through everything about retention and how many, I mean, if you're in compliance at a Fortune 500 company and you require people to record all messages, I know what you're going to say if I ask you if people use Signal. No. And then you're going to hang up the phone and go back somewhere else, because you don't want to look. But you know they're using it, securing it from a very minor threat. And just looking the other way when it comes to everything we were told about retaining messages and all of that. And how does this happen over and over again?
I want to play a little game here. Suppose this happened to us, and I'm sure it happened to us. I think we've all been through this. But imagine this happening in our companies that we worked at. How do you think, and instead of, you know, let's just say we send it to the competitor, or we send it to someone, we didn't want them to have that information, we accidentally send the wrong information to the wrong person, or the right information to the wrong person. How do you think the CEOs and CFOs or GCs would how would they react to this? And would they go completely again 11 on the dial, or would they say no, it's okay, mistakes will happen? How do you think people would react to this?
I think they're on the chats. Hey, yeah. I mean, I have a friend scenario. Hey, is this an incident? Do we want to declare this to be an incident? Is this reportable? Is this a breach? Those sort of internal deliberations, like pre-decisional, a lot of these are pre-decisional sort of things. And a lot of times we just don't know until we've kind of resolved that. Mm-hmm. And some of those things we just don't really want people to see until we've come to some internal conclusion. And what we would typically do in a 20, 30 years ago is we'd all get in a room and talk about it.
Yep.
And none of those are recorded. So a Signal effectively is the form of that room that we get together. We just, you know, can't do that today as easily. So we just have to recognize that the given is that we already miss a lot of communications just because we weren't in the room where it happened.
Well, I mean, Mario, I think you're getting it. Would someone be fired over making this gaffe? Look, for the human error side, I think there's good analogs in acceptable communication paths. So for example, sending email to the wrong person, right? That's huge. I mean, that's a industry-wide plague, where people address the wrong company, right? JP Morgan sounds like Morgan Stanley, RBC sounds like RBS, and someone named Jeff Smith, that one's always getting the other one's email, I can tell you that. So that's super common. I've had a lot of visibility at multiple companies into that type of incident. I remember seeing across, I think at least two different arenas, investigations being accidentally sent to the party being investigated. That's almost as bad as this, except without the media side of it. And so to Mario's point, were people immediately fired for doing that? No, not at all. It was very sympathetic. It was, what can we do in technology to make this more obvious? And we did that, right? We implemented things like Tessian, right? Which, Proofpoint company now. Tessian was and by the way, I was invested in that, but it sold out, so I have nothing more to gain from it. But Tessian was the only thing in town that would say, hey, you normally, before this email goes, you normally send to Sunil Yu at RBS and you're sending to one RBC. Is that what you meant? And that stuff was really took off. It was really popular because people sympathized with the UX challenge in there. And that's how I think this would be treated. If you want to get to the, oh, you made a bad decision, you should have known better than to use that, well, that's a totally different discussion about whether that's people
But you went and bought an application. So suppose this, at least that's what I'm assuming. What I think is it our job? Do we feel like an event like this happening, human error, do we push back as security professionals and say, no, this is bound to happen? Because what ends up happening is, I don't want to blame the GC here, okay? I'm not trying to blame the CEOs, but some folks might go really hard and they're going to want to, you know, the whole thing about insider, they're going to want to clamp down more. They want to try to put in more controls that's going to impact potentially productivity, right? So do we try to say, no, wait a minute, do we try to reason with people? Or do we follow? Do we go with the wave and say, yeah, we need to implement more more software, more controls?
Well, I mean, I think if you handle it as a defensively, like, oh, you're blaming me, it wasn't my fault, it was actually the person's fault, then there's a cultural problem to begin with, you know, because it shouldn't be, this was technology's fault. But I think it's totally fair to say, we're fallible here, we're making some errors. Hey, heroes, you're great at fixing problems a lot. Can you fix this one too? And if I can fix it, I'd love to. I mean, that's what keeps us employed, right? So I don't think that's unfair. I mean, you meet somewhere in the middle, good education, awareness, training, and the technical controls, and hopefully together you get somewhere. All right, enough about Signal, as much as we all want to just talk about it forever. Man, did you guys follow the GitHub actions and backdoored actions here and this whole snafu about, what is this, TJ actions, changed files actions, compromise, and all the news stories they were breaking? Did you guys watch that pretty closely?
Yeah, it affected us because we used that particular code. I mean, obviously, the what it did in terms of sharing credentials, well, fortunately, none of our code was public, so it didn't matter as much. But what was also interesting was that this was a targeted attack against Coinbase. And I think Jerry had mentioned it in a prior podcast, which is, if you are a crypto company, you are getting these very targeted, high effort, high value type of attacks. And we just sit back and, you know, can enjoy the popcorn and potentially get affected by some of these too downstream. It's interesting that people are putting quite a bit of energy into these things because there's potentially a big payout. I think the whole, I actually expected years ago that we would see more of these supply chain attacks, people taking over repositories and such. So maybe they are, and we're just not seeing them, detecting them yet, but, this should be standard. We need to have better controls around this, and I'm not sure if there's really, if the market has really caught up, the security market has caught up to provide them yet.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I know somebody asked there was a window between when this revelation came out and then someone later said, aha, I have evidence here that it's targeting Coinbase, where people didn't know the motive. And I saw someone speculating, like, Well, that's really weird. Why did they publish? I think it was in repo logs that the secrets would be published in. I get it, but why not just exfiltrate them, right? Why not post pastebin or whatever? Because if so, this would just be Armageddon. And you know what it came out to be is because they weren't. It wasn't about Armageddon. It wasn't hacktivists. There's a lot of hacktivists that would love for that to happen, right? That's the classic Fight Club final scene where all the banks are burning down, just anarchists, that sort of thing. But this just shows that they're not really organized well enough to do this kind of thing. When you see something like this, it's probably someone who's looking for another $1.5 billion payday like they had with Bybit. And that's probably good news, to figuring out that generally the motives don't align with the larger hacktivist groups here. So it turns out it was very targeted, it seems, and people were trying to be stealthy and not create a big Armageddon, big bang. Yeah. But Mario, I'll echo the point you made a few episodes ago, that is this the tip of the spear, and
yep.
are these tactics going to go downstream?
Yep. I worry about this just because I've seen this play before, where there's money, people are going to go. Now, there's not that many. There's only a few Coinbase out there, right? So Coinbase is a special case. But imagine going after, I don't know, some software, some database that contains a lot of information. You know, people are using it. This could be a way for them to infiltrate. This is yet another way to infiltrate some of our SaaS applications, our common SaaS applications. And the more, you know, the more we leverage each other, this is the problem with open source. I love open source, and I'm a big open source believer, but this is the problem of not, one, trusting it and not keeping an eye on it, you know? So you need to trust and verify when you use this open source. And I know it's going to sound like, my goodness, I'm going to sound like I'm bringing back the 90s or the 2000s. But this thing reminds me of like how people are potentially going to exploit. This might be another vector for exploiting other software vendors who are very popular that can then become a conduit to get into companies' data.
Well, let me throw a hypothetical out there. What if, even 5 years ago, this exact same TTP had been deployed against closed source software, down to logging secrets, and it had been exfiltrated to a private specific site?
SolarWinds?
No. How about the other 45 things that we don't know about at all? I mean, think about how this one ended up on our screen right now. It's because it's open source. If it's not, nobody knows. If anybody is worth their salt out there on the adversary side, that has to have happened over and over again. I mean, plus the code is probably not super strong to begin with anyway, because nobody's reviewing it either.
Well, I would wonder how one gets access to that closed source, or how one
you find the contributors, right? Supply chain. I know you use something from this small shop that writes code. I'm getting RCE on that small shop, and I'm looking at their repos, and no one's monitoring a thing. It's scary.
Yeah, and there's also, if you remember the book Cathedral and Bazaar, the argument that Eric makes is with, you know, sufficient number of eyeballs, all bugs become shallow. And that particular view has worked pretty well with open source, where open source generally tends to have fewer bugs and fewer security issues just because of the premise of more eyeballs. I think some of that may change with the introduction of AI agents that will go and scan code for you, where they become our eyeballs, at which point one can make an argument that the closed-sourced software may actually end up becoming more secure, because you're going to have your own, as many eyeballs as you want internally.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you went to that before, and it would really open my eyes. I mean, it's a good point, and it would change it. But right now, I think the asymmetry is in favor of open-source software when it comes to security on it, because of those eyeballs. All right. Last thing, and this is developing still soon, but there's been this constant back and forth for maybe a week now of Oracle's breach. No, it's not. Yeah, it is. No, it's not. Look, I got proof here. I got the book that says this sort of thing is my bag, baby. No, it's not. Back and forth. You know, as of today, the way the data rolls out, you know, someone's purporting to have breached Oracle Cloud and stolen a bunch of data and shown evidence that a few sources are saying they can confirm that it definitely is. So this is very possible. How big of a deal is this going to be?
There's just the fog of war, and people in media and talking heads over there, they're going to want to grab the headlines. And I think we just got to be patient and see what's going on here. Neil brings up a very valid point.
Yeah, there's a lot of fog of war.
My understanding, they're distinct. I did, you know, from research I've done on it, that my understanding is that they're distinct. And if nothing else, this is new. This is net new as of very recently right now.
This is net new?
Meaning in the last week, as opposed to Change Healthcare related and the Oracle issue related to that. But I think for a lot of, like, especially tech CISOs and startup CISOs, they would wonder, what's Oracle Cloud? But I mean, that said, I get it. In the Fortune 500, there are people who know the answer to that. There's a lot of people who use it. Maybe not the CISOs, but somebody there does know it. They have it's hard to even call it market share. I don't put this in the same pie as Azure and GCP and AWS. I don't think someone bakes off Oracle and those. I think people who are using Oracle Cloud, maybe IBM or something like that was the other choice, but I don't think that they're comparing and saying, well, Wiz comes with GCP and Oracle Cloud doesn't. But that said, it is a big chunk of revenue and it is a big business.
My sense is there is more to this story. There's probably a third party, some sort of integrator. I have no idea, okay? I'm going to go with what I've seen in the past. And maybe it's an integrator for a bunch of Oracle customers. And that integrator got compromised and popped. And so it's not an integrator working for Oracle, but an integrator that specializes in Oracle. And then they might have, one of their employees, one of their engineers got popped, had secrets to multiple Oracle customers' accounts, and those credentials were then leveraged to steal Oracle data. Now, Oracle customer data. And now all of a sudden, everybody's saying, well, is it Oracle? Is it the cloud? Is it Oracle's cloud that's insecure and that's being breached? And I'm gonna stay neutral on this. I think there's probably, again, I think there's an integrator. I think something else. I'm gonna give Oracle, believe it or not, the benefit of the doubt on this one.
Okay. Well, I think. So let's just be clear. Cyber hugs to the team over there. I'm sure it's a bit of chaos for anybody who's ever gone through this. There's a lot of fog of war. And there's a lot of us who are also asking for more detail. And I wouldn't be surprised if the team just doesn't have that yet, right? They're mm-hmm. still trying to sort things out. It's tough when everything seems to be crashing in on you. So, cyber hugs out to the team out there.
Yeah.
I would guess that if this turns out to be that they were denying it early on, then everyone, including us, are going to second guess, and we're going to start talking about how to do incident response and whether or not you should be more transparent, and we're going to talk about transparency again. If this turns out that they denied it and there really was a breach, my hunch would be that they weren't trying to lie, that they had no idea whether this was a breach or not or where their systems were or who their coworkers were. It's just – and it's not just fog of war. I mean, this environment, in my personal experience, has been – dysfunctional. So I wouldn't be super surprised about that.
My money's a system integrator. That's where I'm going with it. I'm going to give Oracle a better doubt.
I like it. My money's on no one will ever find out because there's no logs. Everybody ever worked on this left 18 months ago. The rest were riffed last week. Yeah. All right. Well, good guys. That wraps us up. We've gone through quite a bit here, and I'm looking forward to the next one already. But thanks a lot, guys, as always, and have a great couple weeks.
Thanks.